Hey, from the court, Mr. Russell McKnight, this is an obvious presentation.
May it please the court. I'm Russell McMaines, counsel for the petitioners Eugene and Angelica Sanchez. In this case, which I believe is essentially a single issue, although presented on several different theories, type case. It arises out of an automobile accident, that is to say, a pickup truck motorcycle accident, to be more specific, that occurred on March 25, 1979 and resulted in the death of the motorcycle driver, Johnny Sanchez, the 14-year-old son of Eugene and Angelica Sanchez. A jury trial was had in which the participation was not only on behalf of the plaintiffs, on behalf of the deceased Johnny Sanchez and his surviving parents, but also by an injured individual who was riding as a passenger on the motorcycle. That aspect of the case has already been paid and is out of the case. The only thing that is before this court is in connection with the denial of the motion for judgment by Angelica Sanchez and the rendition of the judgment NOV in favor of the defendants Schindlers, who have no contest, incidentally, in this appeal with regards to their liability for the accident and their fault in causing the death of Johnny Sanchez. The only issue is the effect of those special issues which inquired as to the recovery on behalf of Angelica Sanchez of a total amount of $102,500 for mental injuries and mental anguish which she sustained as a result of the death of her son, Johnny Sanchez. It is our position, and has consistently been our position, throughout this matter, in both the trial court, the appellate court, and here before this court, with the writs granted, I believe, on all of the points that present this issue, that the principal thrust of the question is the appropriate measure of damages, A, under the wrongful death statute in Texas, for the death of a minor child, and whether it should encompass the elements of damages that were submitted in the special issues in this case, which we contend that it should be, and that it should do. Secondarily, that there is at least an independent cause of action, which we have, for want of better terminology, characterized as tortious interference with family relations, which would justify the submission of the same type of issues. That is an alternative argument. And I wish to first address the initial argument because the principal thrust of our argument is that there not being any specified measure of damages and no limitation on the measure of damages under the wrongful death statute, that being done and accomplished only by judicial construction of the court, that the times as they now exist, the nature of the claim as it is properly presented in the current set of social circumstances demands, I believe, as indicated and suggested by Justice Spears in his concurring opinion in Bedgood versus Madeline, which is one of the principal authorities which we have relied on in the submission and attempted disposition of this case, that it should encompass both a claim for loss of society and a claim for mental anguish over and above the claim for loss of society or mental injury, if in fact there are circumstances, extraordinary circumstances, that justify that, such as are present in this case with regards to the undisputed testimony of the mental, disastrous mental effects that have been had on the mother, Angelica Sanchez, as a result of suffering the death of her son in this accident. As I indicated, we have no liability issues in this case. While there were some indications in the Court of Appeals that there were pleading problems, there are no special exceptions in this case. There are no objections to the charge in terms of the manner of the submission of this case. As to the state of the pleadings, or as to the state of the evidence to support the submission of the issues, except the claim that the law will not allow for the recovery of the type of damages which we have sought and secured from the jury in this case. Now, in all candor, there was, of course, a pecuniary loss, as it has frequently been characterized, the standard form of submission in wrongful death cases, a pecuniary loss issue straight out of the pattern jury charge, Volume 1, not having had the benefit of Volume 3 at that time, that Volume 1 pecuniary loss issue was submitted, and it was answered zero by the jury. We, of course, contested that in the Court of Appeals. It is, in the course of my research, the first time in the history of this state in which a zero pecuniary loss issue has been affirmed in connection with the death of a minor. I could find no other cases on it. The closest case in point was the death of someone who at that time was a minor under the definition of minors because he was 20 years old. But, and therefore, at the time of the existence of that case, which is the Montoya case, the court had held, the Corpus Christi court, in fact, that the findings were against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence and reversed and remanded. But the Corpus court in this case said, and I do not think wrongfully so, perhaps, that we can't say it's against the great weight of the evidence because of the incredible restrictions on the pecuniary loss recovery and the definitions that are contained in the pattern jury charge, which had previously met with approval by the court. The question is whether or not, therefore, the effect of that judicial construction of Article 4677, which merely says, as this court has noted before, and most recently in Bedgood versus Medlow, merely says that the jury shall award such damages as they think proportionate to the injuries resulting from death of the surviving beneficiaries. That's all it says. It's not a measure of damages. It merely is a dictate to the jury that they must allocate among the stated beneficiaries. This court has indicated, or that is to say the predecessors to this court on the bench, have indicated that that was limited to so-called pecuniary losses, actual benefits in terms of pecuniary value, benefits of a pecuniary value. The courts have very subtly, in the course of the last 60 to 70 years, eroded some of the earlier interpretations of that issue anyway by the inclusion of, for instance, in the ordinary wrongful death of an adult case, care, loss of training, the types of things which are very closely akin to a direct recognition of the right to recover for loss of society, but nonetheless has continued with the exclusionary instruction which says you can't consider loss of society or grief or bereavement. That definition, that restriction, of course, stems from the early English interpretations of a statute which closely is similar under English, under British law, which was then known as the Fatal Accidents Act and has subsequently become known as Lord Campbell's Act. And Judge Dean Prosser has for many years criticized that attempted limitation as being totally unrealistic. He said in modern times it was an unrealistic attempt at a measure of damages for the death of a minor child to suggest that we are to put up on the chalkboard some kind of a weight factor in which we assign value in money terms that the child could render for his services and the sweat of his brow to the parents and deduct on the other side the cost of rearing the child. As Dean Prosser appropriately points out in his treatise on the law of torts, in every edition that he has done and in numerous articles that he has written, and as most commentators have agreed, when you put that on the ledger, a jury which followed that instruction would almost inevitably come up with a negative value assigned to the life of a minor. Particularly the younger the minor, the more negative the value would become to the extent of actually rendering a credit for the defendant. The question, therefore, is whether or not the laws of this state as interpreted by this court in accordance with sound judicial and tort policy demand that we allow compensation for what is a clearly recognizable legal liability and claim. Namely, the wrongful death statute is a relational statute. It is designed to protect relational interests. And the damage to those relational interests is exactly what should be compensated for under Article 4677, directly under the Wrongful Death Act, and not just the arbitrary restriction on the amount of benefits of a pecuniary nature.
Well, wouldn't those damages have to be punitive?
No, Your Honor. I suggest that they are compensatory. Now, the problem with punitive damages creates an even greater problem. The court is aware, even for an intentional killing of a minor, if it's an unemancipated minor in terms of having no spouse and no heirs of the body, there is no constitutional cause of action for punitive damages in a death case. either for gross negligence or an intentional tort even. That is a cause of action created solely for the benefit of the heirs of the body and the spouse under the Constitution. Moreover, in terms of an ordinary case, such as our case, if the evidence in our case were that the defendant intentionally ran over and killed Johnny Sanchez, no exemplary damages could be sustained in that case either, because there is no finding by the jury of actual damages from the pecuniary loss standard. And the court has consistently held that even in intentional torts, you don't get exemplary damages unless you get and support actual damages. The analogy which I have indicated and the necessary conclusion and logical extension of the argument for the pecuniary loss limitation, in brief, and in the Court of Appeals, is that a person, a minor, who is severely handicapped, incapable of contributing in a pecuniary manner to his parents, may be intentionally killed, grossly negligently killed, that this homicide can be committed without recompense in this state under the current status of the limitations under the wrongful death statute interpretation. Because he is incapable of contributing in a pecuniary manner, he is therefore worthless in the eyes of the law, and I submit to the court that the legislature in Article 4671 specifically mandated that there shall be liability for wrongful death caused by carelessness, whether it be ordinary negligence, and certainly for gross negligence, and that that should be the policy of this state, and so that the question is, what is the nature of the compensatory elements of that loss? And my initial argument is that under Article 4677, we now have the framework, as this court expanded and recognized in Whittlesey versus Miller in 1978, that a relational loss is as real a loss and is as compensable a loss as is pain and suffering in an ordinary personal injury case. That the recovery for the mental injury, the mental anguish, and the loss of society under these circumstances are things that this court have recognized now are compensable and are subject to being measured in pecuniary terms. Now, perhaps in an arbitrary way, if we were to take a strictly definitional approach, we could say, okay, Article 4677 is limited to a pecuniary loss. What does that mean? 1910, the Supreme Court on International Railroad versus McVeigh says a pecuniary loss means something that can be measured in money. In Whittlesey versus Miller, this court said a relational loss, loss of consortium, loss of companionship, love, the mutual right of solace and affection between the husband and wife may be measured in money terms. That is a compensable loss. So from a purely definitional standpoint, there has been a change, a dramatic change in the attitude of the courts as to the compensable elements of damages. The difference was that in 1910, when the court wrote that in International Railroad versus McVeigh, mental anguish apart from physical impact wasn't recoverable at that time. And then that concept has consistently eroded. But the restriction of the pecuniary loss measure of damages has continued unabated in this state, principally in the death of minor cases. I'm not suggesting that there is any grave injustice at the present time with regards to the measure of damages in a wrongful death case of a supporting adult. But I would cite to the court the example in Dover versus Perez, in which the courts have begun to be confused as to what the pecuniary loss, so-called, limitation is. Dover Corporation versus Perez is one of the cases in which I had the misfortune or fortune of handling. The Corpus Christi Court of Appeals said this amount of money that was awarded by the jury for the death of a father in that case, because he was a low-wage earner, was too excessive. They cite a case from the called Best Harding versus Steele Corporation, which is a standard remittiture-type case out of the Tyler Court of Appeals, which in turn cites an opinion from the Fifth Circuit, the United States versus Simpson. The significance of that is that these cases are talking about there is some kind of a ratio between those types of pecuniary losses that may be recovered under the wrongful death statute and the non-pecuniary losses that are recoverable under the statute. And that terminology is used in all of those cases. the care, counsel, advice, training, assistance, have all been characterized now as non-pecuniary losses already. I suggest that the courts have basically become confused as to what the concept of a pecuniary loss actually means. It is a term that has long outlived its usefulness, if in the beginning it was intended to mean only that amount of money, that amount or those types of damages that could be measured in monetary terms. For the courts have progressed, and the tort law of this state has progressed significantly to recognize that these elements of recovery are real losses that are entitled to be compensated. The real loss in the death of a minor, whether a handicapped minor, one incapable of making pecuniary contribution to the family, or whether it be one who is a child starlet and capable of making significant pecuniary contributions, that the measure of the life of that individual and the resulting injury to the surviving beneficiaries under the wrongful death statute is essentially and principally a relational damage, and that the court should recognize that compensation under Article 4677 is totally authorized for that relational element of harm. When you kill or injure my children, you injure me. That's what Article 4677 says. How do you injure me? Not because my 4-year-old, my 6-year-old, and my 6-month-old child can give me any pecuniary benefit, but because of the tremendous relational damage to the survivors of the family unit.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
This is a 14-year-old child.
Yes, sir.
The scope of your argument is Leon Green's article, relational damages.
Judge, I might add that he may have borrowed a little bit from Dean Roscoe Pound's article in 1916 on relational interest in domestic relations, who makes the same types of commentaries.
Let us suppose that this child were 30 years old. Now, would the argument be the same? You're construing the statute.
I understand, Judge. And my argument...
Are we talking about between 14 and 21 or any child?
Your Honor,
the parents live on the East Coast and the child killed on the West Coast.
My argument with regards to the relational damage and the relational injury is the same under the statute. Now, that's the reason that I have made the second alternative argument. The gravest injustice of the statute, it is my perception, is in the compensation for the death of minors. And should the court wish to restrict its holding to this gravest of injustices under the current system, then it could recognize and limit an independent cause of action for damage to the relationship of parent-child, and in turn confine that to a minor child. But in all candor, I see no limits to the initial and threshold argument which I suggest. And that is that with regards to all beneficiaries under the wrongful death statute, by the interpretation of Article 4677, that it is essentially and initially a relational statute. It is for the benefits of the surviving relatives of a specified class. And anybody that fits within that class should certainly be entitled to compensation for the damage to that relational interest. Now, of course, if the parents and the child, adult child, have been separated for a number of years and have very little contact, that's the type of evidence that can be weighed with regards to determining the extent of the loss, and is something from a fact standpoint that juries would be required to weigh. I don't consider that to be any difficulty. The same way that the fact that a loss of consortium claim under Whittlesey versus Miller could be asserted even though the husband and wife had been separated for some time. There could be evidence that they might get back together, and that's something that the jury could consider, but it does not deprive them of the right to the cause of action as declared by the court in Whittlesey versus Miller in the first instance. So the court is correct that while I am asking this in the context of a minor child, because that is the area of the gravest injustice that requires remedy in my judgment, it is nonetheless, if the court does interpret Article 4677 in the manner which I have suggested, then it would, in my judgment, apply to all of the various relational interests that are involved in Article 4677 and the people that are entitled to recover.
Can you help us on, you're innovating here, can you help us on how far or whether other jurisdictions have taken this step?
Your Honor, I have attempted to do that in part in brief. I'll be glad to supplement with the court. The general rule, there are some 30-some-odd American jurisdictions that thus far have recognized either by common law interpretation or by statute, the majority of which are statutes similar to our own that they have interpreted by judicial decree, have extended lawsuit society to the entire class of beneficiaries. It is not limited. When lawsuit society and when mental anguish are recoverable, they are recoverable under those statutes by judicial construction and the liberal construction of the remedial intent of those statutes, consistent with anybody who is entitled to claim beneficiary status under the statutes. Now, in 1960, in the case which I cited, Weiko versus Notke, Michigan Supreme Court, which deplored the preservation of the pecuniary loss restriction on the measure of damages and the classic construction that had been given to Lord Campbell's Act in some jurisdictions. That case then said that the majority of American jurisdictions already recognize the compensability of loss of society for beneficiaries under the Wrongful Death Act, not limited to minors, death of minors, but a reciprocal measure. And again, the reason is because the measure of human life under those statutes, the courts have basically determined, should not be dependent solely on the degree of wage-earning capacity of the individual who is killed. It is sometimes a much greater harm. There is, in many circumstances, a much greater need for the recompense to the survivors of the low-wage earners who have been greatly demoralized and deprived by the loss of a low-wage earner than by the survivors of a high wage earner who stand to inherit perhaps a great deal of money in the first place. And to suggest that we must vary the measure of damages resulting from the death solely on the grounds of wage earning capacity and pecuniary contributions would be abhorrent, in my judgment, to the fundamental precepts and concepts of equal protection under the law. The laws are not designed solely to protect the rich or the children of the rich or the wives of the rich, but for all men. And the measure of life and the value of the decedent to the remainder of his family is a legitimate inquiry that should be submitted to the jury and determined by the jury based on the true measure of the essential damages, which is the relational loss. Now, the pecuniary damage that, in regards to loss of wage earning capacity, is an element of special damages that may also be submitted, and in certain cases, of course, may result in much greater reward for those who are high wage earners. But that should be no reason whatsoever for denying recovery or denying the concepts upon which recovery is predicated to either low-wage earners or, for instance, minors who are not employed at all. As Dean Prosser indicated in his material, to continue with this artificial standard is to invite juries to disregard the law, actually to encourage disrespect for the law, for all substantial awards under this type of language would either of necessity be remitted by an honest court that was attempting to follow what the law was as it had been articulated under the pecuniary loss limitations, or that they would invite them to merely ignore these limitations and go ahead and give an amount of money that they think just under the circumstances, which is exactly the disrespect for the law that should not be generated by the courts of this state. To say that the only way we get recompense and compensation for the genuine losses sustained by the survivors of the decedents is by encouraging and permitting and authorizing juries to ignore the recognized limitations of recovery.
Now,
is in my judgment
unacceptable. But now on the pecuniary loss, you have an instruction that you can give the jury so that they're just not at sea.
That's correct, yes.
Have you thought through as to what kind of an instruction, maybe what kind of limitations would be placed upon this measure of damage?
Yes, Your Honor, and point of fact, I have another case before the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi, in which we submitted it in my judgment, in perhaps the way in which preferably it should be done. We submitted a single issue inquiring, find the, from a preponderance of evidence, the damages that were sustained as a result of the death of this individual. The first element, we say consider the following elements and none other, is the standard pecuniary loss definition, with the exclusionary instruction under that element. The second element is damage for, essentially as we submitted it in that case, the injury to the parent-child relationship, which is defined in virtually identical terms to Whittlesey, less the sexual components that are included in the Whittlesey instruction.
That's not how you did it in this case.
That is not the way it was done in this case, Your Honor, and that's correct. Unfortunately, I didn't submit this case. But we went one step further in this case in accordance with the order of priority in Judge Spear's concurring opinion in Bedgood versus Madlin, and that is to submit also the concept of mental anguish for the survivors, or mental injury in this case in the context in which it was submitted, which I might add without objection, apart from that there's no legal theory that allows a recovery. And the mental anguish aspect of the case, the limitations that the court wishes to place on that, whatever they might be with regards to physical manifestation or the necessity for psychiatric testimony, we have met in this case.
But so your issue inquired as to what the injury the mother sustained from the accident.
So it's from the occurrence. That's right, Judge. And of course, it might be very questionable as to exactly what the occurrence in question means. But essentially what it means is, and the way that the testimony is developed, is the death of the child.
And that's the way you inquire in the later case.
And yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And I think that is probably the more appropriate manner. Again, that question is asked without objection as to the form of its being asked. The only objections that are made is that there isn't any legal theory to authorize such a recovery. Our position is that for the relational damages involved, that certainly the loss of society should be a recoverable element under Article 4677, and secondarily that in appropriate cases, mental anguish to the survivor should additionally be acceptable as recovery. At least when there are physical manifestations to support the recovery. That is to say, mental anguish over and above ordinary grief and bereavement that I think that is totally justified on this record and on the evidence. There is no dispute as to the evidence as to the tremendous traumatic depressive reaction that this lady has had as a result of the injuries in question and the death of her son, Johnny Sanchez. In summary, our argument is that it is time that this court, as I think Bedgood versus Madelin was the harbinger of the attitudes of this tribunal and of the state, it is time that we recognize that the tremendous element of damages that thus far has gone uncompensated and the tremendous injustice that has been wrought by previous restrictions on these elements of compensation, which are judicially imposed and not legislatively mandated, that the time has come for that to change and that we should recognize that this is a relational statute and the relational losses are real, not imagined, that they are entitled to be compensated and that those losses include the $102,500 which was rendered in this case for the mental anguish of Angelica Sanchez, and is accordingly that the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be reversed and the judgment of the District Court should be reversed and judgment rendered for us in that amount. As I've indicated to the court and not spent a great deal of time on my independent argument, the court understands the nature of my alternative argument, is if the court is concerned only with remedying what is probably the grossest injustice, and that is the death of minors, then the court, I believe, is free to write on a clean slate as to the tort of tortious interference with the family relationship, much akin to the recognition of the independent cause of action for loss of consortium that was created in Whittlesey versus Miller. I believe, however, that the better reason rule would be to go ahead and expand the relational elements to encompass all beneficiaries. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The argument from Ms. Palmer.
May it please the court, Mr. Bill Meredith will present argument on behalf of Ms. Palmer.
Members of the court, Ms. McMains. Some extremely interesting questions have been presented by Mr. McMains in his application and in his oral argument. And when this court considers and writes upon and determines those questions, there'll be momentous decisions for the state of Texas, the lawyers and the citizens of the state of Texas. But this court is not a committee that is to get together and write an article as to what the law in Texas should be under these circumstances. This court must decide this single case presented to us, to the court. And two out of the three doctrines or approaches submitted by Mr. McMains for reversing the judgment of the trial court and the Court of Appeals were not preserved for consideration by this court. Now, basically, he asked reversal on three grounds. First, that the wrongful death action of Texas in Texas should be reconsidered and held by this court to include elements for damages such as loss of society, companionship, and mental anguish, and that should be recoverable here. The second theory, he says, well, if not that, there should be an independent cause of action that he entitles a tortuous interference with the family relationship. And if not that, then this is a bystander recovery case in Texas and one to which the doctrine should be extended and applied. And of those three, only the third is squarely presented to this court, and it is still quite an important point for this court to write upon to give guidance to the citizens of this state and the lawyers representing their rights. Now, what happened? Why weren't these important social questions argued by Mr. McMains preserved and brought forward in this case? Was it that Bill Edwards and David Perry and Guy Allison didn't know what they were doing when they were trying this case for the plaintiffs? Of course not. This was a case where there was good liability and bad injuries. And it wasn't a case at the time this was going to the jury that looked like any case that they wanted to build an appeal or an attest case on based upon the suggestions of future law by Justice Spears and the concurring opinion of Bedgood versus Madden. So they presented the issues, they pled the case and presented the issues in the traditional classical ways. And I hope I haven't been presumptuous in preparing excerpts from the record and asking the marshal to place an excerpt before each member of this court. All of those items there are either from the transcript or from the statement of facts in this case, I think all but one from the transcript. Because, again, I asked the court, and I know this court is going to key in on what were the pleadings in this case, what were the issues submitted, what did or did not the petitioner do to preserve his points of error. So what have we got to decide? And when you come back to that, you have a situation in which there was nothing preserved for this court to decide on the wrongful death, on expansion of the wrongful death recovery, or upon creation of a new cause of action. Now, let me suggest to you why that is true. First, as to a wrongful death claim that would encompass recovery for loss of companionship, loss of society, or mental anguish, there was no pleading of any indication that an attempt wanted to be made to recover for those elements. I have presented as the first exhibit the trial pleading signed by Gallus in this case, and you'll see that what is presented is a traditional type of language, very general, asking for recovery on the wrongful death action and suing individually for injuries to them, which was being presented, as we'll show more fully, presenting the bystander liability recovery for mental injury or injury to Mrs. Sanchez that they were attempting to recover in this case. There was not a clue in the pleading that they were attempting to enlarge the elements of recovery for wrongful death in Texas. Now, we don't have to just look at the pleadings as the way they went into trial at the beginning. Near the end of trial, they filed a trial amendment. That's item number two. And they specified more completely what they meant by the damages they were seeking for Mrs. Angelica Sanchez individually. And if the court will look at the language in paragraph 2 there, you'll see that it's a very close paraphrase of the language used by Judge Spears in the first paragraph of the concurring opinion in Bedgood versus Madden, saying that that these damages should be recovered by Mrs. Sanchez because of her perception of the event of the injury and death of her son, Johnny Sanchez, keying it right into bystander recovery. What issue then was submitted by the plaintiffs in this case? Well, we have before the court the issues. The wrongful death issue was submitted by the plaintiffs in the traditional language, limiting loss of pecuniary damages and specifying what could be considered and what could not be considered, and saying specifically on the request of these plaintiffs' attorneys that nothing shall be allowed for loss of society, sorrow, grief, and similar elements. And of course, there were no objections to the issue by the plaintiffs. It was their requested issue. At that time, the jury hadn't come in, and they thought that, you know, that they would have a good recovery that they could take and walk away from with their clients there. Now, then the court went ahead and presented, by the way, the Bedgood versus Madeline decision of June 4th, 1980, came down as we were going to trial in this case. It may have been the day we went to trial or a day or two after. That was argued on motion in limine to this trial court. It was presented while evidence was being presented. And Judge Yeager, I think the court will see in this record, tried very faithfully to not only follow the present law, but on bystander recovery, on the question of a mother whose child was injured, to leave open a question for the plaintiff's attorneys to present if this court wanted to broaden or thought a time had come to broaden and write upon whether or not the recovery for a bystander is going to be limited to the so-called zone of danger situation, with the bystander being in the zone of danger, or whether it would adopt the California rule of Dillon versus Legg and say, well, if the bystander has a contemporaneous perception of the injury, whether they were in a zone of danger or not, they may recover, or whether to go beyond that, as no other court, I think no other court has done in our country. But the trial judge, therefore, allowed an issue to go to the jury, even under the facts of this case, as to the pleaded injury to Mrs. Sanchez under the bystander theory. And that's presented in these issues, I think it's 35, 36, and 37. But the inquiry there, you notice, wasn't asking about mental anguish. This wasn't trying to bring in some element under which is now being claimed by Mr. McMeans to apply under wrongful death. It asked whether or not Mrs. Sanchez was injured. Defined injury to be an injury, physical damage or harm to the physical structure of the body, either physical or mental, including emotional neurosis or traumatic neurosis, I think. And the jury just said, yes, they found an injury. And then the damage issue was submitted with all the traditional elements of recovery, lost wages, physical pain, mental anguish, past and future, just like she had had a legitimate or a physical injury herself, let me put it in those terms. So, what happened, though, this jury returned a verdict, and it was not a jury that went all for the defendants and tried to see the plaintiff got nothing in this case. The jury returned a very large verdict and many elements for plaintiffs in this case. They found $50,000 for the conscious pain and suffering of Johnny Sanchez for some 2 hours of conscious pain and suffering. There was substantial evidence of severe suffering. But that's a more than substantial verdict we submit. When they got to the wrongful death issue, they answered none under the instructions of the court and under the traditional interpretation of that law that was submitted to them. Now, what happened was when the verdict came in answering $50,000 conscious pain and suffering, no damages under the wrongful death issue, and $100,000 damage under the injury to Mrs. Sanchez, which was submitting the bystander recovery, an idea dawned. It was conceived after the trial by Mr. McMeans, why don't we try to bring this case under the rule that Justice Spears has suggested ought to be considered in Texas in Bedgood versus Madeline. True, we didn't think about it while the case was being tried, but why don't we try to bring it in now? Further, when you got into the briefing aspect and started getting ready to file his brief in the Court of Appeals, another idea was conceived. Well, the majority did express in Bedgood versus Madeline that this has been the well-settled Texas rule and interpretation of the wrongful death statute for 90 or 100 years. The legislature has considered this statute repeatedly, amending it in 1973, And 1973, they added an article on the change of name. In 1975, I believe it was, they amended two of the articles. Then they've had other bills before it to enlarge the elements of recovery. And so, Mr. McMaines, when he conceived the difficulty that the court might have, even in a proper case of changing that interpretation, he decided, why not look for a new cause of action? Damage or tortious interference with the family relationships, and create that in this case. So that's when that idea first came up. The opposing counsel never knew that he was going to come up with either of these presentations in the trial of this case. The trial court didn't know it. Court of Civil Appeals was the first to learn it, and I submit the plaintiff's attorneys didn't know they were going to submit these theories until the midst of the appeal of this case. Now, with respect to what is submitted by this court, let me talk just briefly on the policy questions, because those have been discussed in Supreme Courts of many of our states in many law review articles. I don't think I have any real new light to shed on the policy considerations of whether or not our law should be changed, or whether or not a new cause of action should be adopted. I might say also that the arguments presented by the petitioner in this case don't present any new ideas. They repeat some of the arguments from the other cases. I will comment on just two or three points that some of those Supreme Court judges and some of the commentators have mentioned on the policy question. And this will relate mainly to the so-called new cause of action here. First of all, on leaving the wrongful death cause of action he claims. I'm leaving this court with a situation where you have the construction that's been applied for these 100 years or so, where there is no point preserved in this appeal to change it. Thirdly, where wrongful death, not being an area of common law, as I understand it, and let me hasten to say I'm no student of the history of law, but it seems that courts have been able to take more liberties in creating remedies and recognizing rights in accordance with the developing needs of the citizens of the state when it is an area that traditionally has been one that has grown by the courts writing upon these subjects, as distinguished from something that does not come out of the common law and evolve, such as statutory remedies. And wrongful death, I think a universal regard, as not having a wrongful death right of recovery, did not exist at common law, was solely a creature of statute. And thus being a creature of statute, which is one that I would suggest that this court may want to look much more carefully before it interferes with, especially since the Texas legislature, it had been construed and the law well settled as to what it means. Okay, now going to this, to policy questions as to whether a new and independent cause of action for interference with family relationships should be allowed. That question has been considered by the jurisdictions, the highest jurisdiction, the highest court, I should say, of a number of different jurisdictions. A recovery for consortium-like elements, loss of society, companionship, mental anguish, is now allowed if I'm in 1981, respectively. The situations were, I believe those are both situations where the parent was seeking recovery for the child's injuries, although one of them could have been the reverse, the child seeking to recover for the parent's interest. But, and I hear I'm going to have to defer to a rather scholarly discussion of this question by the dissenting Supreme Court justice in the Michigan Supreme Court, who states that some 18 other jurisdictions over the past 15 years or so have considered whether or not there should be a new cause of action allowed for a parent for recovery for a child's injury, or the reverse, a child for a parent. And all but first Massachusetts and then Michigan on that day had rejected such a new cause of action, including two courts, he commented, that are not known for timidity in recognizing and creating remedies where a remedy appears to be needed, and he referred specifically to the Supreme Courts of New Jersey and California, both of whom considered these causes of action and rejected them as going beyond the bounds of what should be allowed for recovery if the courts are going to recognize that every time a defendant is negligent, that anyone who has any sort of damages, even though they may be, is not going to be compensated just because he has any sort of relationship with the person actually injured, the victim. California specifically, and I think this is between 1978 and 80, rejected the right either for a parent to recover consortium-type damages because of the injury of his child, or for the child to recover similar type damages for injury to the parent on companion decisions considered and handed down on the same day. Bora versus American Airlines, and the other was a Baxter case, I believe. But all the other jurisdictions that have considered this question have said, well, that's going too far. Whittlesey versus Miller did allow the consortium recovery in the state of Texas. That has been the trend. It cited and followed the California case, the Rodriguez case that allowed that. And since that time, as I mentioned, California had considered whether that should be extended to the parent-child situation and held that it shouldn't. The relationship by husband and wife is very different from that of parent and child. That's not to say that there can't be a close relationship in parent and child, but it's extremely different. It has it's usually a lifelong relationship. The companionship is much closer. It has the sexual aspects involved, and it's different as is recognized by the writers, and thus one to which the courts have felt, well, we'll extend the right to recover for these loss of society, companionship, mental language, and make an independent cause of action for the spouse when his wife or husband is injured. But we're not going to extend it any further than that. And I think that's a just and correct place to draw the line. I do want to turn, before I conclude, to what I feel is the real crux of the only issue submitted to this court in this particular application for writ of error and preserved for appeal. And that is, how far should bystander recovery be allowed to proceed in Texas? Now, because the facts must govern the test that this court and the trial court allows on the foreseeability question, I have included in the excerpt before you a portion of the statement of facts where Mrs. Sanchez testified. And I will only paraphrase that here she was at home, not at the scene of the accident. They received a phone call to her neighbor that her son had been injured. They lived in Rockport. They went over to where got in the car and headed over to Key Allegro, met a young girl, asked what had happened, and she said, well, Johnny's in the ambulance or going to the hospital. They saw the ambulance, no reference to hearing any sirens. That's a misstatement by Mr. McMahon, I'm sure, inadvertent. Went back home, got a neighbor to take him to the hospital, and they got to the hospital perhaps an hour after the accident occurred, about a 30-minute drive. And at the hospital, Mrs. Sanchez was never in the room with her son. She stated they wouldn't let her go in. She testified that she saw his legs on a table through the door, swinging door, and saw some blood, or there was blood. She did not state there were blood on his legs or blood on him. That's not in the record. That's not cleared up. And she stayed in the hospital in an outer room until he died, perhaps an hour after that. Those are the facts that the trial court and the Court of Appeals and this court have to look at in this case. Now, no trial lawyer in Texas and no trial judge exactly at this time knows how far bystander recovery extends. We do know that this court, starting with Hill versus Kimball and Rittenham and Kaufman versus Miller, has indicated that at least it probably extends as far as to someone in the zone of danger. That the true test is whether or not the tortfeasor can, whether the negligence of the tortfeasor can be said to be such that it was foreseeable that the person bringing the action might be injured or have damages. And what Kaufman seemed to indicate that for someone who was in the immediate area and where the accident occurred and was not unusually susceptible to emotional damage, that it probably extended at least that far. Now, if I read Kaufman correctly in the comments in there, that was the last expression of this court, and I think that was 1967, I believe. Now, the court majority was very careful in 1980 in the Madeline versus Bega versus Madeline case, when sending that case back for retrial, to say that with respect to Dr. Madeline's cause of action, it wasn't properly pleaded, but with respect to his cause of action for bystander recovery, where he was in the backyard and heard the yell of his son and the thud striking that boy, or apparently which could be infant striking the boy, and was awarded damages, that we expressed no opinion on the merits of that claim. But several courts of appeals, including the Corpus Christi courts of appeals, in trying to go back and analyze the language of this court, and trying to determine how far foreseeability should be allowed to reach before it's cut off as a matter of law, have analyzed and discussed with favor the test set forth in the California decision of Dillon versus Legg, which basically is a three-pronged test repeated by Landris versus Reed in 1978 and repeated by Corpus Christi Court of Appeals in 1980 in its Bedgood versus Madeline decision, and that is, one, the foreseeability test shall be gauged by these elements which need to be present. One, that the plaintiff was in the area, immediate area of the accident. Two, that the plaintiff had a contemporaneous perception, that the shock or mental injury to the plaintiff was caused by a contemporaneous perception of the accident as distinguished from learning of the accident later from others. And third, that there's a close family relationship between the plaintiff and the victim. Two of those three elements are missing in this case. Mrs. Sanchez was not at the scene of the accident or anywhere near it. Second, Mrs. Sanchez undisputedly had no contemporaneous perception of the accident itself. And therefore, even should this court feel that the limits of foreseeability should reach as far as contemporaneous perception of the accident, as Dillon versus Legg in California said, as some other courts have adopted, as Justice Spears said that he believes this court should allow it to extend to, still that would be no comfort to the plaintiffs or the petitioner in this case, because it does not approach that. In order to allow to extend bystander recovery in this case, this court would have to go further, I believe, than any other court of high court has gone in any other jurisdiction.
Counselor, are you saying that it should be based on the extent of foreseeability?
Yes, sir. And I believe, and I do think that, and most courts, high courts, have said that should be the test, and this court said it in Kaufman versus Miller. The problem, Your Honor, is how do you determine that foreseeability? And I suggest that certainly that the zone of danger, that is, that the person being in the area and being threatened of being have injured themselves, is probably the correct measure. But certainly no further than the person having an immediate shock from seeing or hearing or feeling the accident occurring to the other. And that's the test of foreseeability.
Are you saying that a person could readily foresee that if he strikes this motorcycle, they're going to kill this boy, but he could not foresee grief and anguish on the part of the parents because the boy's dead?
Oh, no. I'm not saying actual foreseeability. If you go by actual foreseeability, Judge Wallace, the ripples would go on forever. A person who thinks, well, if I'm going to get drunk and go out and drive, for example, and I might kill somebody, and that one person killed, I think it's foreseeable, in fact, that the person's husband or wife is going to be damaged as well as the person you killed, their children, their parents, their close friends, their law partners, if it's a lawyer, the club members they're close to, innumerable people are actually foreseeably going to be damaged. But I think it's a very different question from what legally should be foreseeable.
In other words, your argument is on restriction of the cause of action and not on limiting foreseeability.
Well, perhaps you're right. I have difficulty with those, with how to phrase it. I think it's a policy question as to limiting the cause of action. And I seem to me that this court and other courts speak in terms of calling that legal foreseeability and say we're going to legally allow the foreseeability to extend so far and no further. And in this case, I'm suggesting that it should be only to the zone of danger or at most to those that have contemporaneous perception.
That might be more appropriate. It's called economic foreseeability.
Well, I don't know if it'd be more appropriate, but I think arguably it could be said that. That's certainly one consideration that the writers and the law review articles and of the Supreme Court opinions of other states consider and talk about as the economic consequences of extending the doctrine. One other thing I do want to mention to this court is that there is a court, there is at least one case I know of that's on the way up here that I think will squarely present the issues that Mr. McMains has argued today before this court, in addition to the case he mentioned before the Corpus Christi Court of Civil Appeals that I wasn't aware of. But at my request, when I found it was pending, Mr. Dave Prager sent me a copy of his brief in the pending now in the Beaumont Court of Appeals in Gulf States Utilities versus Reed. There, the mother lost a 13-year-old boy. And according to the brief, the plaintiff's attorney and the trial judge both decided to make that a test case under the language suggested by Judge Spears as to what should be the law of Texas. And so pleadings asked for all of these elements in the wrongful death, loss of society, mental anguish, divorce. It asked for a separate mental anguish, mental injury, and mental anguish to the mother. And the jury in that case found $10,000 conscious pain and suffering and $20,000 in wrongful death damages, $500,000 in the loss of society and companionship, and another $500,000 in the mental anguish, additional mental anguish suffered by the mother. And that case is now on appeal and before the Beaumont Court of Appeals and will squarely present the issues that are not preserved for presentation of this to this court today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Hear rebuttal arguments on petition.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I think that I could glean fairly securely from the argument by the respondent that he does not wish to confront any of the policy arguments or the arguments for the propriety of the change in the law in this case, but rather wishes to beg off this court from deciding the issue at this time, and I submit to the court that it is squarely presented in a number of its aspects in the context of the pleadings, the evidence, the charge, and the judgment issues in this case.
Counsel, I'm having a little trouble with the charge.
Yes, sir.
Where in your issue, you instruct the jury, do not allow any amount by way of consolation and so forth, or for any sorrow, anguish, or grief, or for the loss of society, affection, companionship. It sounds like the jury did just exactly what they were instructed to do.
Judge, that's an instruction that, of course, where it is positioned in the charge, relates only to the pecuniary loss issue that was submitted in its classic terms under PJC. And, of course, this court has held repeatedly that the failure to give that instruction under historic precedent in conjunction with the pecuniary loss issue was reversible error. So that what we are faced with at the time of trial is what all lawyers, I suppose, who are trying to have their cake and eat it too in the trial court are faced with. And that is that first we attempt to comply with the law so that if the jury, as I have submitted already in argument, wishes to ignore these restrictions and to at least by some gut justice reaction award a significant amount of money for the death of Johnny Sanchez under what I consider to be basically the fake test of the pecuniary loss rule, we would have taken it. And there would probably have been no appeal, except possibly by the other side, with regards to excessiveness on that issue.
Counsel, the way to preserve the error in this instance, it would appear to be to request an issue that would define things in a way that relational damages could be considered, which the court under existing law would deny. And then your point would be the denial of that request.
Yes, Your Honor, of course, that would then have necessitated a retrial of the issue. If we were right, we then have the opportunity to go back and have to present all the liability issues again, which have already been resolved and of which there are 18 volumes of record testimony, 17 and a half volumes of which bear on the liability issue. Now, what I am suggesting is that the function of the mental injury submission was a separate submission, and it is argued all in the charge, at the charge stage and the objections to the charge, that Judge Spear's concurring opinion in Bedgood versus Madeline doesn't require him to be present at the scene, that this is the type of loss that we're talking about. There's never been an objection to the pleadings by special exception. There's never been an objection to the charge on the absence of pleadings with regards to supporting the submission of that issue. There is no objection to the form of the issue, saying that it should have been done a different way. So that the real question which we had presented and which we attempted or was attempted by Mr. Allison to present was the second half of Justice Speer's analysis in the closing portion of the concurring opinion, and that is that he thinks that loss of society should be directly recoverable because of damage to the relational interest, and additionally in the appropriate case that mental anguish and mental injury should be susceptible to being compensated under the Wrongful Death Act directly. Now, our position is we sued under the Wrongful Death Act. We also sued individually. We sued as a result of the death of Johnny Sanchez and all of the other ensuing events because we weren't sure what the law was or where it was going. At the time, particularly, as Mr. Meredith has indicated, that this case was tried because we didn't have Bedgood versus Madeline at the time the pleadings and such were done. Now, I personally believe that the issue is presented because we are talking about what are the component elements of a recovery under the Wrongful Death Statute. Pecuniary loss is clearly one of them. And there should be an exclusionary instruction, much like the double recovery instruction, with regards to the limited pecuniary loss elements that have been previously recognized. But there are additional elements, and I submit that mental injury was one of the additional elements, which is suggested in the concurring opinion, and which is authorized, and we don't have to plead that we are claiming that this is recoverable directly under the Wrongful Death Act. We have pled that we have been individually damaged as a result of the death of our child. And we have also pled as beneficiaries under the Wrongful Death Act. There is no requirement, really, to plead measure of damages anyway. That's a question for the court. The application of the appropriate measure of damages standard, particularly when no issue is presented as to pleading, is something that has been spuriously erected at this time to attempt to postpone, yea, once again, the resolution of the important policy questions, which I think this court does in fact squarely face now.
Counsel, but we require predicate. We don't write in the abstract.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your issue 36 asks what would reasonably compensate Angelica Sanchez for mental anguish, which in reasonable probability she will sustain in the future until the end of her life. Does that embrace it?
Yes, Your Honor. The elements of our recovery in connection with the mental injury and the mental anguish submission that we submitted, the source of that, whether it be the Wrongful Death Statute or some independent cause of action, or perhaps even an extension of the bystander recovery argument, which we acknowledge would have to be extended in order to reach this particular recovery, which is why the purpose of the other arguments, because it is a separate and distinct argument, and one which I think does not really present the essence of the issue that we were trying to get at, and that is that when we have, it is a relational damage, I concede to the court that with regards to the specific limitation of loss of society, that there was not a separate submission of the loss of society element. That's obvious from the charge. But the mental anguish element, in Judge Spear's opinion, is there. And the fact that the loss of society was not there, it is a stepping stone, because Judge Spear's concurring opinion indicates that we, first of all, recognize that there is no limitation in Article 4677 as to the measure of damages. that it is a relational loss that we are talking about, and that loss of society and companionship should be available to be submitted in any case in which the evidence raises, and secondly, that additionally mental anguish in the appropriate case should be entitled to be compensated.
Counsel, that being so,
yes,
when you were instructing the jury about consider this element, this element, this element, and go all the way down to H, why didn't whoever tried this lawsuit ask, include I,
loss
of society?
Judge, I can't read Mr. Allison's mind.
Well, that's our difficulty.
I understand that, Judge. And it's my difficulty from the standpoint of trying to make the square presentation of loss of society alone, but that's not all we're dealing with. Mental anguish is an element that is submitted. It is one which we got an answer to. It is one which we moved for judgment on. It's one which we were denied judgment on, and that's an adequate predicate to determine is mental anguish recoverable in a wrongful death case, either under the wrongful death statute or as an independent cause of action, either for tortious interference with family relations, or on the basis of the Bedgood versus Madeline and the extension of the bystander recovery principle. The latter I have not argued because I think that's essentially a dodge of the issue. I think that the contemporaneous perception limitations in the Bedgood versus Madeline majority opinion, which I perceive to have recognized the existence of the cause of action, if the elements are met, and merely fails to comment on whether or not this constitutes one since it has to be retried as being unpled. Cause of action didn't exist, the court would not have remanded it to be retried. So that I feel confident that the majority has already recognized the existence of a Bedgood versus Madeline opinion and type of cause of action for experiential perception of the loss. But my position is that absent parents, doesn't matter whether they are at the scene. That's a separate issue because the bystander recovery argument is just that. It is an expansion of the concept of trauma. Initially we had physical impact, moved to zone of danger, bystander recovery expanded in Dillon versus Legg and I think was adopted and embraced in Bedgood versus Madeline to include as well those foreseeably who are injured and suffer emotional reactions to witnessing the injuries to other when they are in the vicinity. Now that's an expansion of the concept of trauma. That's not what I'm talking about. We're talking about a relational loss. The testimony by the psychiatrist in this case, which comes in without objection in any way, is talking about that the fact of her problems and the traumatic depressive neurosis that Mrs. Sanchez is suffering is directly attributable to the object loss of her son. The death of her son is the cause of her problem. That's the nature of the element that was submitted. And the sole thing for the decision in the trial court and here is whether or not that type of mental anguish under those circumstances, which would require an extension of a Bedgood cause of action on a different ground, or, more realistically, that we recognize the existence of the relational aspects of that statute. We recognize that we have the right to go that far, that mental anguish in appropriate circumstances, and there's never been any question of the evidence justifying it in this case, should be recoverable directly under the statute, that that is an additional element. In the course of that decision, I suggest that the court will also face the question of what are the other elements, even though it was not submitted. Much like this court did in General Motors versus Hopkins in discussing the issue and the defense of misuse, in attempting to formulate it for the guidance of the trial bar, to suggest what they mean by the interpretation that they are afforded. This court can limit its decision, I concede. Of course, this court has basically, under a Holmesian analysis, the ability to do more or less whatever the court decides is best, regardless of what I ask the court to do. On the other hand, I submit to the court that squarely at issue is the recovery of mental injury and mental anguish, directly under the wrongful death statute, or as an independent cause of action on any one of two independent theories. That issue is squarely preserved. The court cannot duck that issue. The issue is one that will have to be faced.
Counsel, and we're not going to duck anything.
I understand that, Your Honor.
I wish that every Wednesday that we didn't have to hand down some decisions. Some of them are painful, but we do it.
I understand, Judge. What I'm getting at, I suppose, is what has been called judicial patience in regards to not deciding issues prematurely. But what I'm suggesting is that this court must, in my judgment, logically, in the progression of the analysis of Mr. Justice Spear's concurring opinion, go ahead and leapfrog over the loss of society issue before we ever get to mental anguish. Mental anguish is a more controversial issue than loss of society. And I submit that the recognition of the recovery and the allowance of the recovery to my client will definitively portend the allowance of loss of society, whether the court decides not to write on it or not. And I submit that the court should write on it, should give us the direction, and that it is certainly time, and I've seen no arguments in brief or orally from the other side to the contrary, that it is time that we recognize the true gist of the cause of action for wrongful death, and that it is not the measure of damages has been left up to judicial construction, and that judicial construction, in the light of the existing social circumstances, dictate that the elements of loss of society, that the elements of mental anguish, be directly recoverable under the wrongful death statute. Or if the court is concerned with regards to the extension to other beneficiaries, it can recognize an independent tort. Incidentally, in one correction of one of the comments by Mr. Meredith, in his argument, in terms of the loss of society issue, there are 34 jurisdictions that recognize, either by common law or statute, the recovery of loss of society, and of those, some 10 or 12 also recognize, that states, 10 or 12 recognize the additional recovery of mental anguish as a separate element. The definition of loss of society in a number of those states of the 34 actually encompass elements which would ordinarily be perceived to be mental anguish anyway. The majority of American jurisdictions recognized that recovery in 1960 when the judge in the Supreme Court in Weichel versus Notke in Michigan said that that was the law. The only issue that he was talking about specifically with regards to two states is the concept of a relational tort in a non-death situation. That's what the Massachusetts and the Michigan opinions in Berger versus Weber and Ferreter and Daniel versus O'Connor and Son relate to, not in death cases. By far and away, the majority rule, 34 states and two territories, recognize the compensability of these elements, which I think are the fundamental aspect of the right of recovery in a wrongful death case, and certainly the denial of those elements in the death of a minor child case leads to reprehensible results, which cannot be justified in the light of our existing standards. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument for both parties. The court will take a brief recess.